Welcome, everyone. Thanks for tuning in to The Collective Perspective, Reclaiming and Reshaping Theater, where artists from various identities, disciplines, and from across the country take a critical approach to the theater industry. If you appreciate the discussions being had on this podcast and want to support our creative activism, you can subscribe or follow us on Apple, Spotify, and all other major podcast platforms. To stay up to date with episodes, upcoming articles, and to get to know The Collective better, please like our Facebook page, The Collective Perspective, and Instagram at TCP Theater Podcast. Reviews are always welcome, and please leave comments or questions, as well as send us an email at tcptheaterpodcast@gmail.com. Welcome again, everyone. Thanks for tuning into this special episode. We will not be centering an article for this episode. Instead, we're going to talk about collective liberation and share some important resources with you. But before jumping into that, we'll quickly introduce ourselves. My name is Ana Sofia Villanueva. I use she, her pronouns. I am a theater producer, director, writer, and activist. I am currently residing on traditional unceded Yakima land in Central Washington. And Sophie, do you want to introduce yourself?
Yeah. I'm Sophie Payton. I use she, her pronouns. I am a theater director and producer. I also do some grant writing and am currently getting trained in intimacy direction as well. I'm currently residing on the unceded and stolen land of the Dakota people, also known as Minnesota, or I'm specifically located in Minneapolis.
Thank you.
It has been a week.
It has. I think instead of doing, because we did kind of a check-in before starting to record, instead of doing a check-in for this special episode, I want to share a few of our collective members' core agreements. In episode 2, they talked more about core agreements, but basically they are a list of values and corresponding behaviors that we agreed to strive to accomplish. I want to share a few of these now because, well, I think it's important to continuously revise and revisit groups' core agreements, but also to foreground our discussion for Sophie and I and for our listeners. So the three I want to highlight are transparency, graciousness, and embracing difference. Using what I like to now call decodification, thank you, Kaja Dunn, we define these terms and behaviors as a group. So for transparency, we agreed on discussing hard and or controversial topics, to honestly express our opinion and share experiences without shaming anyone, to speak from our own experiences without being a representative of our identities, to be honest about our capacity without trying to push through physical or emotional barriers. That one I don't always accomplish. and to be candid about our boundaries. For graciousness, we agreed on calling out in a respectful manner when, and it is always when, someone makes a mistake, and to recognize and empathize with another's blind spot or gaps in knowledge. And for embracing difference, we agreed to support and uplift one another's experiences instead of engaging in oppression Olympics or trying to one-up who has it the hardest. And we also agreed to uphold one another's intersectional and complex identities instead of assuming a person's identity, policing their identity, or asking them to be representative of their perceived identity. So I also bring this up today because I've been seeing among Latinxes and other people of color and other groups of people that are my people, a lot of transparency, but not enough graciousness and embracing difference. We'll get more into that in a little bit, but as you listen to this special episode and go about your day, I ask that you try to put the values of graciousness and embracing difference into practice. And that's actually how I define culture, values in practice. So let's try to shape the culture of the environments we inhabit. And I will strive to create that culture with you today, Sophie.
Yeah, absolutely. And I also, I'm just grateful and appreciative for you picking those specific core agreements to uplift as well. Because I feel like specifically just in Minneapolis right now, and with the recent verdict, of course, and also the recent murder of Dante Wright, I feel like I want to call on all leaders and all of my city officials and all of the people in power at the theaters here for the same things, for transparency and graciousness and embracing difference. So I am grateful that you uplifted those specific ones today and want to also carry, I hoped that like gets carried forward to people who hold power in my city and also just in our society right now too. They are values I want to be larger parts of culture in general.
Yeah, thank you. So with these core agreements in the foreground, Do you want to talk a bit about the recent events that compelled us to do a special episode?
Yeah, I feel like we're in this moment of trauma on top of trauma on top of trauma, where like you don't even have a moment to catch your breath or like process for large communities are re-traumatized by what's going on. I mean, I think it's fair to start with just what I've seen in Brooklyn Center in Minnesota and the murder of Dante Wright. And for those who may not be following the news super closely, we felt like it was important to just give an overview of what happened and what we're seeing and why folks are as furious and upset and full of despair at what this event was. So on April 11th, 2021, just this month, just a matter of days ago, Dante Wright, a 20-year-old Black man, was fatally shot by a veteran police officer. He was pulled over for expired tags in Brooklyn Center, Minnesota. And it's worth noting, for those of you who don't live in Minnesota, but during this pandemic, our DMV, as I'm sure many are, very overloaded and backlogged, and police officers have been explicitly instructed to not stop folks for expired tags. I think it's like important to name that that is the case. Once Dante was pulled over, officers found out that he had a warrant for his arrest. I think it's also important to note that this warrant came about because there was a court order for Dante that was sent to the wrong address and never actually made its way to his hands. So because of this warrant for his arrest, he was then proceeded to start being arrested by officers on the scene. He attempted to get back into his car at that point and was then shot at close range. He began driving off and crashing his car, where officers ended up following to the scene, pulling him out of the car and pronouncing him dead there. This was a 26-year veteran officer who shot Dante. And later in the body cam footage, it was shown that she had mistaken her gun for her taser.
Is that true that she actually did? Is that a fact or is that...
The video shows her going taser, taser, taser. Because when you bring about a taser, from what I know, and I do want to preface this, I am no expert. I am just like an individual who tries to read a lot. But apparently when you use a taser, because of like the way it functions and its electric shock, all hands have to be off the person who's being tased or the other people will also be tased. And so it is protocol to say taser when you're about to use it because everyone needs to then back off. So in the footage, she did yell taser, taser, taser. And then as Dante got in his car and drove off prior to crashing, there is her heard on the footage of "I just shot him." And realizing that she was not holding a taser, but she was instead holding a gun. There's, of course, now been a lot of information coming out about like where police are told to keep their taser on their belt versus their gun, because this is clearly not a like complicated issue. And this is something that like is in training for officers. So like you don't mistakenly kill people on the job. There's also been a lot of information just about what a taser looks like versus what a gun looks like. All of those things to be said is sort of, for me, feels like really getting stuck in the trees without seeing the forest and realizing that the fact that Dante Wright was pulled over for expired tags in Minnesota when officers were told not to pull people over for that specific thing is actually the problem here. He should have never even been in an interaction with police to begin with. Whether or not she mistook her taser for a gun does not fucking matter to me. What matters to me is that Dante Wright was profiled enough to be pulled over for something that officers were told not to pull people over for.
Right. And I think that we have seen enough of a pattern to say that if he were white, that wouldn't have happened.
Yeah. And what does it say that a 26-year on the force officer who is in charge of in the field training cannot tell the difference between a gun or a taser? What does that say about the way that we are training these people?
Yes.
I think it's also important to uplift what happened to Adam Toledo in Chicago. So on March 29th, 2021, Adam Toledo, a 13-year-old Latino, I believe Mexican-American boy, was shot and killed by the Chicago Police Department in the Little Village neighborhood on the west side of Chicago. For those of you who may not know the full details of this story, it was in the very early morning that two officers were responding to reports of gunfire when they saw two people in an alley and started to chase them. Prosecutors have said that Adam was holding a gun when he was running down that alley. In the video footage, it shows that the officer yelling at him was yelling at him to stop. The officer continues screaming and escalating and cursing, telling Adam to drop his gun. And I quote, "Hands, show me your hands, drop it, drop it." Adam then drops the gun behind a wooden fence. As he turns around and lifts his hands and does exactly as the officer instructed, they open fire and they shoot Adam in the chest. This officer has been placed on 30-day administrative leave. And thus far, there are no upcoming charges and there is no accountability that I have seemed to find moving forward on this case. There has also been a disproportionate focus, similarly with Dante Wright, on the circumstances surrounding the shooting, the fact that he was armed, the fact that Adam was out late, rather than the fact that the police killed an unarmed child. Chicago's mayor, Lori Lightfoot, urged people to, quote, reserve judgment because, quote, we don't have enough information to be the judge and jury of this particular situation. Let's wait until we hear all the facts, end quote. And yet, of course, this officer in Chicago was able to act as the judge and the jury and the executioner for Adam. A child out at 2:30 a.m. should never be a death sentence. I think it's really telling to me, and just because a 13-year-old Adam Toledo was out at 2:30 a.m. and had a gun, that somehow we can't focus on like the same kind of clear vision of justice that we all saw when we saw the video of George Floyd getting murdered, that we all felt when we saw the video of Dante Wright getting murdered, that it just is abhorrent to me that it's even a question or that it could even be considered an excuse that just because a 13-year-old was carrying a weapon, that this would ever be deserved.
Yeah, that scapegoating, blaming the victim for having a weapon and dehumanizing is not a new pattern. We've seen it with Micaiah Bryant just recently.
Yeah, I'm realizing in this moment, I thought it was Makia, and I'm not sure that I've actually heard her name said out loud.
I haven't either. And I would say look it up, but I also really don't trust media to get that right. I mean, just look at the victims of the Atlanta shooting.
Yeah, absolutely. So Makia Bryant was murdered on the day of the verdict of the Chauvin trial, literally a matter of minutes after the verdict was announced. Makia Bryant was a 16-year-old Black girl who was shot by police in Columbus, Ohio. The situation is very new. It just happened 2 days ago, and it's still unfolding. But what we do know is that the police received a 911 call from a woman who has been unidentified at this point, who told officers that people were trying to fight and stab her and others. Police arrived on the scene quite quickly to see Bryant and another woman struggling next to a car. In the video, Bryant is seen holding what looks like a knife. Many gunshots were fired very shortly after the officers arrived on scene, and Bryant immediately fell to the ground. In the video, you can hear bystanders begin to yell at the officer, saying he didn't have to use his gun, and the officer responds with, "She had a knife. She just went at her." And a bystander replies, "She's a fucking kid, man. Damn, are you stupid?" And I can't help but think, in reading that and in listening to that, I cannot get out of my head the image of a young white man walking into a protest in Kenosha, Washington, armed with a very, very large gun, actively shooting peaceful protesters, and somehow making it into custody alive and perfectly fine. And I know that the situation with Makia Bryant is new and unfolding, but what we do know is that it really seems like police are fully able to remember their de-escalation training when white people are violent and armed. But somehow a 16-year-old Black girl deserves to die just because she has a knife in hand. To see all three of these murders laid out within, 2 weeks, and also a guilty verdict, it just continues to make me think about how we talk about what's going on and where we focus our energy. It's hard for me to separate this from conversations I was a part of in the uprisings after George Floyd's murder, and the way that folks in my network who were not in my city shifted their narrative so quickly, while I should be fair, as well as lots of people in this city, shifted the narrative very quickly to looting and property destruction and violence, and how vital it is to remember what this is actually about. And it is not about the intricacies of the moment that this happened, or the split-second decision that the officer was forced to make, but it is about, why does a young white man who is armed at a protest get to just have the small moment of at least making it into custody? And a 16-year-old Black girl, a 13-year-old Latino, a 20-year-old Black man somehow don't even get to just make it into custody.
Yeah.
But I would like to take a moment right now just to pause for these three individuals' lives and the fact that while like you and me, Anna Sophia, maybe, but we as a society and a culture that continues to live and be entrenched in white supremacy and in many ways continue to perpetuate and uplift white supremacy have all failed these three individuals, and that the justice that they really deserve is one that we will not be able to see. Thank you.
Yeah, it's quite clear that one just verdict, one rare moment of accountability does not change the system. Black folks are still being targeted and killed. Their lives are still not valued. And we still have a lot of work to do. It doesn't stop here with one moment of accountability. No, it doesn't.
Yeah.
And that's also true with Adam Toledo. You know, police brutality and killings of Latinxes, especially Latinos, is not a new phenomenon. Obviously, I am heartbroken and outraged by the murder of Adam Toledo, of course. But what I am grateful for is that we're finally getting some national attention on the police brutality and killings of Latinos. As I said, anti-Latinx violence is not new. It is a regular occurrence that happens at disproportionate rates, going largely ignored for centuries, literally. And I'm sick of it. Not just the physical violence and constant fear of physical violence and hypervigilance, but the internal violence that erasure causes. And by erasure, I mean the denial of the complexities and heterogeneity of Latinxes through simplistic depictions and narratives about who we are, where the perspectives, histories, and our lives are misrepresented or completely disregarded. So I'm glad this is finally starting to gain some national attention. But to be clear, I am not saying it should receive more coverage than the state-sanctioned murders of Black folks, which does include many Latinxes. There are Black Latinxes that are not reported as such. Just take Army Second Lieutenant Caron Nazario, who was recently pepper sprayed and arrested during a traffic stop. He is a Black Latino or Afro-Latino, but largely reported by the media as solely Black. So this erasure of Black identities of Latinxes makes the comparison less Black and white than media and statistics report. But ultimately, it doesn't need a comparison. Black and or Latinxes are still being targeted by the police, being incarcerated by the masses, and experiencing systemic oppression. Sure, we may be racialized differently at different times and undergo racism differently at times, but it's all part of the same shit. And we need to be showing up for one another. But I don't think that's happening as much as it should be right now. Instead, I'm reading a lot on social media posts and hearing stuff that is becoming increasingly more divisive. And I am using that word correctly, not like how white folks call me divisive when I point out racism.
Can you actually share a little bit about what we've been seeing happening with the We See You White American Theater? I don't know, I guess maybe call it a collective. I think it's fair to say like it is an anonymous group. And I do think that that's there. While I understand the choice, I also recognize the inherent problem in that anonymity. But would you mind just speaking a little bit to like what has happened with that in the past couple of weeks that we've seen online?
Yeah. I think that's a great example of that division. So apparently, and I say apparently because I'm inferring based on people's comments on Insta and Facebook. Oh, look at me being all cool with Insta. So I didn't actually see it. I think it was a story. So it's since disappeared. But apparently, We See You White American Theater held a town hall for BIPOC to discuss anti-Asian racism. That's what I'm inferring again. And either Black folks didn't register or didn't attend. And We See You What responded with some sort of sarcastic Insta story about how they weren't stepping up to support AAPI communities. Whatever it was clearly not handled well by We See You What. And then came all this backlash. People started posting how it's wrong for, we see you want to say Black folks aren't doing enough, which I get, and saying that they are sellouts with their merchandise, you know, that if you've seen the We See You Want merch, yeah, and that they should have provided action steps and there can't be accountability without clear leadership. And then it spiraled and saying Asian Americans are model minorities anyways and not really people of color. And there were even big names canceling this movement. Prevalent Black theater leaders and critical thinkers who joined in, such as Anne James from Intimacy Directors of Color, who wrote that the movement was destined to fall flat from the start. And to make matters worse, We See What followed this up with a petty post of fake apologies. Did you see that one, Sophie?
I didn't see fake apologies. I saw the graphic that sort of was very simple, large, bold text of like maybe a matter of 50 words responding to the event.
Okay, yes, you're right. I guess to me, it read as disingenuous.
I think
we're sorry, we aren't perfect, we're sorry, it was something to that effect. It didn't really seem like they were addressing their poor handling of this. And it was almost like a child took over their social media. And all that noise, there was no discussion being had about why so few Black folks showed up. In what could have been a great moment to recognize, well, first, that Black folks are exhausted, but also that we do need to link movements, that we need to show up for one another. In all of that chaos, where everyone is expressing transparency, very few were expressing graciousness and embracing difference, at least in how we as a collective are defining it, where a large component of how we try to practice embracing difference is supporting and uplifting one another's experiences instead of engaging in oppression and Olympics, such as thinking the placed label of model minority is not incredibly harmful and racist to Asian folks. And yes, racist. I've been noticing a lot how people like to use the word discrimination when it comes to AAPI communities. But yes, they are people of color. Non-white people who experience racism. Now, I understand that we did not create these core agreements with all of social media, but it is a great example of the kind of divide I'm seeing as multiple movements are gaining national attention at the same time.
Thank you for giving us that overview and like insight into that experience. I wish I was cool enough to be on Instagram, but I'm really bad at social media. So,
well, I'm so uncool that I had to point out that I said Insta. So.
Well, I'm grateful to have that update because I do think sometimes when these things happen on social media, with the way that social media is like intended to function, that these things disappear. I think it is indisputable that the We See You White American Theater movement has had an impact on white American theater. Whether that will lead to actual change is to be determined, but it has had an impact. And I think the criticisms that came are incredibly valid.
I agree that there's valid criticism of We See You What, but I'm not even trying to make an argument about who was right and which aspects of this argument were valid or not. I'm actually talking about how quick both sides were to cancel the other. How quick they were to not really talk through why we weren't coming together as people who all face racism and systemic oppression.
Absolutely. I mean, I think often about the movements that have happened in this country for cis white women's rights and the way that feminism, the several waves of feminism, have moved through this country over decades. And it feels very similar. The oppression that all women experience and non-binary people experience and trans people experience and trans women and trans men experience, that oppression is inherently linked. That marginalization has to do with gender and gender oppression. And it's abundantly clear when you go back to history, it was not a secret that white women said us first and told Black women, we'll get to you later.
And all women of color.
And all women of color and any other marginalized gender under that umbrella. You know, I mean, I think we saw that a little bit more in second wave feminism with TERFs and et cetera, but as we have seen in history, Waiting for sequential movements does not work. White cis women did not start a movement for all women's rights in the 1800s that then led to trans people being treated as human beings today. They did not. That did not work. It did not work to say, me first, you second. And I actually feel, while I know that this is true, and I know that there are people in this country that have been erased and their stories have been erased, who have been fighting for collective liberation, and that there is a legacy of that, I don't believe that we publicly see movements be linked in the way that you're discussing.
There have been coalitions and movements across racial identities in the past, but no, I'm not seeing it right now. And something that is occurring to me as one of our core agreements is communal education and something that we try to practice here. Sophie, can you speak a little bit to how you define collective liberation?
Yes, I can. For me, collective liberation, well, let me back it up because I think, you know, I think collective liberation is like a topic and ideology in many senses. But I also just want to speak personally what collective liberation means to me. I feel as a white cis woman that there cannot be movements for racial justice and movements for liberation that do not focus on the core reasons that this oppression is happening. I feel as a white person that I too have been harmed by white supremacy. It has destroyed my education. I was in school for 20 some odd years, and the perspective I got on the world was a singular one of a singular race from a singular gender. And that has impacted me now for the rest of my life. What was supposed to be my core education that was supposed to be guaranteed in this country was biased and simplistic and full of erasure and not the story and not the full story. So, and that is just one example. That doesn't even include the fact that I feel like white supremacy has taken people out of my life. It has put me in situations where in the city where I grew up, like Boston, which is incredibly segregated. And while I grew up in a very mixed neighborhood, that doesn't mean that there wasn't lines and divisions in my school systems, in my classrooms, for my teachers, right? So that all of this to say, and I could rant about this for quite a while, is just that I feel that collective liberation just means that all of our struggles are intimately connected. And that it requires that we all have to work together if we actually want to have the world that we want and that we deserve that is free from white supremacy. I feel strongly that all people deserve respect and dignity and safety and deserve to thrive and have as normal a life as they want to have. I feel like that cannot happen if I, as a white person, am not linked to those movements and to all of the pieces of those movements. And to me, that doesn't mean racial justice. That also means economic justice. That means housing justice and food justice. That means the intersection of racial justice and environmental justice, because who's going to be impacted most when climate crisis hits? It's communities that are under-resourced and under-supported. So to me, collective liberation, it means the connection of all of those things. It means that the root of the thing that is hurting all of us, we have that in common. And while the ways that that manifests or comes out or is experienced, all of those things are different. They are complex. That is why we have the core agreement of embracing difference. I see no other way forward than to be linked to the essence and the core of why we are here and what our country was built on, which is oppression of people in the name of power and power hoarding.
Whew. Yes.
I feel very passionately about this subject, primarily because I feel like inherently in white supremacy, white people hold the majority of the power. Therefore, they have the most power to impact and move change forward. And I often see white people in my life sympathizing with movements while not actually doing anything to, I want to say move movements forward, but I guess that doesn't feel like really effective language, but I think you understand what I mean. And so without this idea of collective liberation, without, just in my experience, without white people linking themselves to the harms of white supremacy and recognizing that they are also losing something in this system that is functioning. Until that happens, I truly don't feel like we'll actually be able to have real systemic transformation.
Mm. Yeah, my focus as a woman of color, as Puerto Rican woman, as a mixed race Latina, and all the complex and intersectional identities that I embody, that my focus is often on, and the past has been on, movements that directly impact my body, my family's body, and mi gente. But I think that that mentality is wrong. We need to take on the movements that our identities embody and those that it does not. Fighting for Black Lives Matter as a non-Black Latina is as important as fighting for equal citizen rights of the people of Puerto Rico. But here's the thing is, I actually think it is possible, particularly with theater people, because we can be at the front lines of changing culture, putting values into practice.
I think, too, for theater people, that our profession requires us to learn history and to understand context. And I think in exactly like what you're saying, that also makes us perfectly positioned in this moment to be able to put things in context for others.
Yeah.
And I've been thinking a lot about what it means to like find your lane in the movement. And what is my lane? Is my lane specifically with white people and education? Is my lane specifically with economic justice and poor white folks in the South? Or is my lane something in regards to voting rights and voting legislation? I am not here to bore you with the nonsense that is going through my brain all the time, but I do think that it's really important and really vital for all of us to think critically about what is your lane? What is the part of this movement that you fit into that you feel like you can throw your energy and your time and your effort and your heart into, so that we, as a larger collective who all want a more just world and want a world that is free from white supremacy, that I know that there you are, Anna Sophia, fighting in your lane, and I'm over here and I'm going to fight in my lane. You are over there supporting that work, and I am over here supporting this work. And in the long term, we can sort of continue to push things forward.
I hear you, but I am struggling with this whole lane metaphor, because to me, I understand what you're saying. Like, we can't do all the movements. Okay, I agree with that. But it isn't a matter of sticking to your lane. I can also empathize with a white person's desire to be a support and listen and step back, but I don't think that's enough. I think it's, yes, educate white folks, do that work, because we're tired of doing it. People of color are tired, and we don't need to be educating white people anymore. So yes, do that work, but that doesn't mean remain silent when you can't see how something else is impacting you.
I'm really glad that you threw that in there, because I, to be transparent and honest with you, I hold on to that like find your lane thing, right? Leaders and activists that I really look to, Alicia Garza and Ai-Jen Poo, have used that language before. And it really hit home for me in a way where I was like, okay, as long as, you know, I can't tackle the whole thing, but as long as I can find my place in what it is, that's great. And hearing you say this, it's like, well, of course, find your place. And yet things are all changing and things will need immediate and urgent attention. And so like staying in your lane is not a very good way to support collective movements.
It's like what a coach used to say to me about, you know, you got to get comfortable with the uncomfortable. And I've used that saying in EDI, and really, you know, that was about lifting heavy weights. But it totally applies to this labor as well, because stepping out of your lane and getting involved with movements that maybe don't affect your children, but do affect your neighbor's children, is going to be uncomfortable. And fucking do it anyways.
Yeah. Yeah. And I also just want to uplift what you said of, while I think that the call for white people to like listen and let people of color lead is not the same as saying white people sit back. It's actually saying, listen first, make sure you're centering the right voices in the right moments, but you have fucking work to do and you can do it in your communities. You know, I think a lot about, you know, as white people, we are not educated on race history or racial justice in public education.
People of color aren't either.
Exactly. And that is, because that is the case, there are a lot of people who are highly susceptible to what that hole in their heart is going to be filled with. A lot of people, and I will speak specifically to white people, a lot of white people will fill that hole with Fox News. They'll fill it with mainstream media. They'll fill it with sympathies for Black folks and their struggles. They will not fill it or what I'm trying to say is that it is on you as a white person. It is on you to fill that for your family. It is on you to put something in that place, because if you're not putting something in that place that is anti-racist, that is eradicating white supremacy, that is decolonizing and standing up against settler colonialism, if you're not putting that in your family members, in your friends, in your coworkers' hearts, someone's putting white supremacy in there for you. And if you don't start chipping away at what that is, if you don't start talking to those people about the mental health and the way that emotions are going to come up in this work and being able to have support systems for that, we just need to move forward. So white people, it's not about stepping back. It's about stepping to a new circle. It's about stepping somewhere else and continuing to do that work.
Yeah. And for BIPOC folks, it's about uplifting and supporting one another. So with that, we're going to hand it over to collective member Lipika to talk about some resources and ways to start getting involved.
Hi, I am collective member Lipika Shaw, she, her, hers, currently recording on the land of the Susquehanna and Piscataway peoples, past and present, though I live and work on the land of the Munsee Lenape peoples, colonially called East Harlem, New York City. It will take work and commitment from all of us to reimagine the way that public safety functions in our communities. The institution of policing is deeply rooted in white supremacy and settler colonialism, and it's inseparable from racialized capitalism. We must educate ourselves on the history of countless reform efforts and why those efforts will always fail in the face of a white supremacist policing institution. There are key elements to the work of public safety: education, policy change, and public demonstrations. We, even as individuals, have the power to impact all three areas. Here are some ways to start. For the first element, education. Educate yourself and others. It is critical that we understand our place in history, where previous efforts have been tried, how we got to this point, and why we must forge a new way forward for the safety of ourselves and our communities. It is important that this labor does not fall solely on the people who are being hurt the most. For example, read MPD 150's Enough is Enough report. It's a 150-year performance review of the Minneapolis Police Department. While this report is Minneapolis-specific, it can help illuminate a common history of abuse and oppression in policing departments nationwide. You can find it at mpd150.com/report. If you are new to understanding the police abolition movement, you can find copious educational materials at mpd150.com/resources. This is an extensive list of books, articles, videos, and other materials on history and context, abolition 101, abolition in practice, meaning real-world examples, as well as toolkits and study guides. Policy as the second key element. For systemic change to policing and public safety, we need policy change at the local and federal level. For example, the George Floyd Justice in Policing Act recently passed in the U.S. House of Representatives. This bill addresses policing practices, including measures to increase accountability for law enforcement misconduct, enhancing transparency and data collection, and eliminating discriminatory policing practices. However, the Movement for Black Lives does not support this bill and have said justice in policing, by its very name, centers investments in policing rather than what should be front and center, upfront investments in communities and people. This bill doubles down on failed approaches to police reform. Instead, the Movement for Black Lives has created the BREATHE Act. This legislation takes a holistic approach to community safety by investing in the non-carceral, non-punitive strategies that have actually worked to keep people safe. You can find out how to take action to support this bill at breatheact.org/action. If you're interested in the legislative work of the Movement for Black Lives, you can find current projects and ways to plug in at m4bl.org/electoral-justice-voter-fund. The Working Families Party is also fighting for collective liberation as a multiracial party that fights for workers over bosses and people over the powerful. They're a core supporter of the Breathe Act, and you can follow their work and activism at workingfamilies.org. While there are essential bills for police reform in progress, many of the policy changes we are seeking are at the local level. It is critical that we all know who is making decisions in our cities and how our cities' power structures function. There are many unique differences in roadblocks, from city charters to structures of government power to the responsibilities and purview of your elected officials. So get intimately familiar with your city council and your mayor and the power that they have or don't have. Know who is on your school board. Changing our curriculums and eliminating the school-to-prison pipeline and SROs are a huge part of this work. Calling our reps and local state and city officials is a constant and necessary step. We must be invested in progress at the local level, because what works in Oakland may not work in Minneapolis. What changes can you bring about in your city that may inform or move policies forward in mine? If you're looking for direct action, check out Nix the Six. Campaign Zero reviewed police union contracts in nearly 600 cities and police Bill of Rights laws in 21 states. And we all know that police unions have too much power. It is beyond time to hold them accountable. So head to nixthesix.org to find direct actions and numbers to call for your city. For the third key element in public safety, consider public demonstrations. One of the biggest pieces of power we hold is public demonstrations and our collective voice. Speaking out online and showing up to in-person events shows how powerful and widespread this movement is and can be. We might not have gotten the same guilty verdict had millions of people not taken to the streets this summer to demand justice. In Minneapolis, public demonstrations literally changed the oversight of the Derek Chauvin case, making Keith Ellison the special prosecutor. Ellison then charged Chauvin with second-degree murder, the most serious charge of which he was convicted on April 20th. Please pay attention to the leaders in your community. Sign up for email lists, sign petitions, follow those organizations on social media. Being connected in this way allows us to respond more boldly and urgently to specific calls to action. And if you are planning to attend a protest, check out blackfutureslab.org/safety for an in-depth, incredible resource on ways to keep yourself and others safe when on the front lines with police. We all have the power to impact this system. If you see someone in a tense interaction with police, stop and witness. Film, take photos. One reason we're celebrating a guilty verdict is because of Darnella Frazier's courage to record George Floyd's murder. The ACLU has created a free app called Mobile Justice. So whether at a protest, at a polling place, or on the go, if you download this app, it allows users to record and report any abuse by authorities straight to the ACLU and its networks. You can also support Darnella through her GoFundMe page at the official Peace and Healing for Darnella Fund. While the abuse and brutality within policing are a nationwide issue, we all have the power to make an impact locally. This change can start with the education of one family member, or calling one city council rep, or posting that one story on Instagram. Progress is a collection of constant daily actions. We need more than individual accountability for Derek Chauvin. We need deep, systemic transformation to bring justice. That transformation starts with us.
Thank you, Lapika. And now we'll transition to Lilia, who is also going to share some information of multiple movements to get involved with.
Collective member Lilia here, they then, with some resources. Collective liberation means recognizing that all of our struggles are intimately connected and that we must work together to create the world we want and deserve that is free from white supremacy. All people are worthy of dignity and respect and safety within systems of oppression we all suffer. And we must fight in intersectional movements for justice and for our collective liberation. So a few of the many movements to support when you have the capacity, I'll list now. Combating anti-AAPI hate. Asian American and Pacific Islander communities have long struggled for visibility and equity. Now, in the midst of the COVID-19 pandemic, Asian and Asian American communities are facing additional mental, emotional, and physical harm. And over the past year, we have seen a sharp increase in anti-Asian hate incidents and violence. And this racism has taken many forms and is not new, but rather exacerbated because of the pandemic. Hate crimes must be reported so there is action and accountability taken to move us all closer to a safer, more just community. StopAAPIHate.org is a reporting center that tracks and analyzes incidents of hate against Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders in the wake of the COVID-19 pandemic. We all have a role in identifying patterns and sources of anti-Asian racism. In reporting hate crimes we witness, we are helping gather data and important information that further allows for practical solutions and policy recommendations to be crafted for long-term change. If you have financial privilege, please donate to the GoFundMe page, Support the AAPI Community Fund. The support of the AAPI Community Fund aims to address the urgent issues that face AAPI communities, as well as broader systemic problems. With the donations received through the fund, grants will be issued to trusted AAPI organizations that work to rectify racial inequalities in our society. We recommend everyone take bystander intervention training with Hollaback. Hollaback has partnered with Asian Americans Advancing Justice to create a pay what you can intervention and de-escalation training that is in response to the rise in anti-Asian American and xenophobic harassment. Sign up and find out more at ihollaback.org/bystander intervention. It is our collective responsibility to condemn these acts of violence publicly and to report hate crimes we may witness long after the COVID-19 pandemic. We must all amplify AAPI voices and find ways to empower and protect AAPI communities. Please check out our special episode from the Collective Perspective, honoring AAPI communities, for more resources and ways to plug in. Another important movement is reuniting families at the border. In spring of 2019, the U.S. Department of Justice and the Department of Homeland Security launched a pilot program in El Paso, Texas, to systematically separate children from their parents at the border. The goal of the policy was to deliver a message of deterrence to future border crossers that the United States would no longer adhere to law or basic human decency in its treatment of families seeking refuge. Despite efforts to reunite families, hundreds remain separated today. The current immigration policy in our country denies entry to those fleeing violence, detains people in abusive detention centers, and forces families apart. This intentionally dehumanizing policy is being carried out by people we elected, and therefore is also a reflection of us. We must take action, or this will become who we are as a country. The Refugee and Immigration Center for Education and Legal Services is a large nonprofit that provides free and low-cost legal services to immigrant children, families, and refugees. Find out how to donate to the Bond Fund. Take action to dismantle ICE detention and apply for long-term volunteer work at raicestexas.org. The Young Center for Immigrant Children's Rights is a champion for children who arrive in the U.S. on their own, from all corners of the world. They act as allies for children while they are in deportation proceedings and advocate for their best interests to ensure the safety and well-being of every child. Their goal is to change the immigration system so that children in immigration proceedings are recognized as children and best interests are made a part of the decision-making process. Find out more at theyoungcenter.org. The Florence Immigrant and Refugee Rights Project does similar work in Arizona and can be found at firrp.org. La Resistencia is a grassroots organization based in Washington State working to end the detention of immigrants and stop deportations. members support and engage with people detained at the Northwest Detention Center in Tacoma, Washington. They are a multiracial, multi-status, multi-gender group that organizes across the prison barrier, Northwest Detention Center, and to end all detention and deportation in Washington State. United We Dream is the largest immigrant youth-led community in the country, creating welcoming spaces for young people, regardless of immigration status, to support, engage, and empower them to make their voices heard. United We Dream puts undocumented immigrant youth in the driver's seat to strategize, innovate, and win, while envisioning a society that celebrates diversity and leads a multi-ethnic, intersectional path to get there. Get connected at unitedwedream.org. Another critical movement that needs more visibility and support is the Missing and Murdered Unit. The severe level of missing and murdered Indigenous women in this country is an epidemic. It is a violent crisis that has been underfunded for decades. Homicide is the third leading cause of death among American Indian women, at a rate as high as 10 times the national average. However, most cases go unreported. Tribes often have no jurisdiction over missing and murdered cases because they are classified as major crimes, and law enforcement agencies, to no surprise, are appallingly inadequate at maintaining complete, accurate records of these cases. By covering up the data and keeping poor records, law enforcement is purposefully erasing the disproportionate impact on Indigenous communities. With violent perpetrators rarely held to account, Native communities remain vulnerable. This month, in an effort to provide more resources to finally begin to investigate the thousands of unsolved cases, a new Bureau of Indian Affairs unit has been launched by Interior Secretary Deb Haaland. Haaland said, "We are fully committed to assisting tribal communities with these investigations, and the MMU will leverage every resource available to be a force multiplier in preventing these cases from becoming cold case investigations." This unit is very new, so keep a close eye as it develops to ensure it is standing by its stated purpose. You can also plug in with the Coalition to Stop Violence Against Native Women, a good place to start and find out how to support further at csvanw.org/MMIW. Also important is stopping Line 3. Line 3 is a proposed pipeline expansion to bring millions of barrels of tar sands from Canada to Wisconsin. Enbridge, a Canadian pipeline company responsible for the largest inland of oil spill in the U.S., seeks to build a new pipeline corridor through untouched wetlands and territory of the Anishinaabe peoples. It's well past time to end the legacy and continuation of theft and destruction of Indigenous peoples and territories. Send a letter to President Biden at stopline3.org/Biden. If you are looking for in-person ways to stop Line 3, check out welcomewaterprotectors.com for resources on how to prepare for on-the-ground activism in northern Minnesota, where the pipeline is scheduled to continue construction in June. You can also find events over the next month at welcomewaterprotectors.com/events, such as the May Day for Mother Earth, a group paddle protest on the Mississippi River, and an introduction to the Fossil Fuel Addiction Treatment Center. The last movement I'll mention, though also crucial, is taking action against anti-queer and trans legislation. Our country has a long history of trying to legislate the queerness out of our communities. Similarly to activism efforts to end police brutality, this work to protect the trans, non-binary, and queer loved ones in our lives starts at the local level. These legislative attacks are not new, but they are increasingly present in recent months. Bills to restrict trans athletes' ability to participate, exclusions to healthcare access, and even simple basic rights like making changes to your personal documents like birth certificates and IDs. Cities across the country are under attack with anti-LGBTQIA+ legislation. Once you know which bills are in your state, you must look to your local state senators and reps and hold them accountable to these violent actions. Be in regular contact with your elected officials and let them know loudly which specific bills you propose. Understand your state's process for passing legislation and know when to call and when to show up in person. Each state will require a unique response to this widespread assault on queer and trans rights. So get local, find the orgs close to you opposing these bills, pick up your phone and stand up for the queer and trans and non-binary people in all of your communities. One bill in one state that gets rejected is a victory for all of us. So that's the list of ways to get started and involved for this episode. There are just a few movements to get involved with and ways to take action. Stay tuned for more. And we need to keep doing the work. One guilty verdict, one moment of accountability is just the start. So let's use it to find hope and motivate us to keep going and to keep fighting. Love to all.
Thank you, Lily and Lapika, again for sharing resources on ways to get started in a few crucial movements that affect us all. And just to say again, collective liberation is everyone's responsibility. It is up to us to shape the cultures of the environments we inhabit, the industry that makes our art form viable and puts us in communion with one another, and to systematically reshape this country. We must fight white supremacy as a collective. Thanks again for tuning in. To stay up to date on episodes, you can subscribe on the platform you're currently listening to or follow us on any of our socials. Thank you for listening to The Collective Perspective, Reclaiming and Reshaping Theater with
Alex Reed,
Ana Sofia Villanueva,
Cambria
Carrera,
Lilia Hushmand,
Lupika Shah,
Oogie Push,
Saimukda Duompusai Vongsai,
Sequoia Hawk,
Shalana Wanch,
Sophie Payton,
Tia Jemison,
Vahishta Vafadari.